This is Louise Bode, February 11th, 1992, talk entitled Animus.
She is one of our, she's on the board and has contributed a great deal to shaping how the coming events are coming. And I'm trying to find a little bit more about her, that's why I'm fiddling around here. I had to hear for a minute. Ah, wouldn't you know? It's right here. Okay. Louise is a Jungian analyst in private practice for over 16 years. She studied at the University of Chicago, where she received her MA, and at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich. She was a founding member and training director of the C.G. Jung Institute in Chicago. And she's also a training analyst for the Interregional Society. So without any further ado, please welcome Louise Bode.
I might add that, excuse me, Interregional Society should get part of the credit or blame for my education. Zurich shouldn't carry the whole burden. How does this sound? Okay. When a friend of mine, heard that I was going to talk about the anima and the animus, they said, "What are you going to say?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure yet. Some of it will probably be something that you've never heard the likes of before. And some of it you could probably do as well yourself." Another friend of mine said, "If you can enjoy it, do it. If you don't enjoy it, don't do it." Well, I'm here. And I think and hope that we can have a good time together. I want there to be lots of discussion, and with a group this size, that can be most lively if you'll jump in. And I haven't decided if I should present the material and then we discuss or discuss as we go along, and I think we need to just sort of feel that out and see which feels best. Just for information, and also as a way into this subject, before you heard about the lecture, this is a dumb question. How many of you had heard the word animus? All right, you're laughing. Now think back to when it was that you first heard it. And I remember when I first heard it, when the word itself seemed to sort of leap out of the page that I was reading. And it was all shiny. You know how some words are the first time you see them or you hear them? And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that there was a great numinosity around this word. And I guess at that time I didn't even know the word numinosity. And it's like when I first saw Jung's book, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, when it first came out and it was in the window of the bookstore. And I had to go around 2 days before I went back and picked it up. And it was literally hot. And this was in the dark ages of 64, 68. But I go into this because this all ties in with what we're going to be talking about tonight and how I see trying to deal and work with the concept of the animus and the anima. And probably we made an error when we build these separately. Because I don't think you can speak of just the animus without the anima. The anima is always placed first, but as we get into the material, we'll see that that's what Jung started from. And rightfully so, I suppose, because being male and the anima being that contrasexual part, that was where his focus was. And some of his writings, as you know, it's almost as an afterthought that he said, and the counterpart would be the animus for woman, and then he lists what it would do. But it's only been recently, I think, that women writers and also some of the male analysts have begun to explore Animus. So tonight I'm going to be talking about both. And next week we're going to be talking about both. And hopefully nobody came just for tonight's session to hear about the Animus and won't be back next week. What we're doing is kind of the tip of an iceberg. And this subject of anima and animus could lead us in so many paths if we were to follow it. And really, as I thought about it, and what some of the current thinking is on it, some of where Jung's thought took it, from the personal to the transpersonal, to the archetypal, to the self, to the numinous. And if we were to follow it, it can lead us to gender identity. There's a lot being done on that today in terms of the anima and the animus. Role identity, it can take us into the realm of religion or spirituality. But as best as possible to hold it so that we can begin to get some information about it. And what I would like to do is to present and to start with where Jung really started. This is going to be a review for a lot of you. And you may even have to fight boredom. But I'm going to ask you, as you listen to some of these old pieces of information, if they've been familiar to you for a while, what's been the impact on your life? What have these concepts meant to you? Think about this in terms of relationship to yourself. For others, the material may not be so familiar, and it'll be a little more exciting, a little newer. But for whichever it is, so that we kind of have a starting place and to feel into this and catch the excitement of where Jung was when he was working with these concepts. Some of what I present tonight will almost seem contradictory, and you're all aware that much of Jung's writings, it's like he was thinking out loud. And some of his earlier works, later he says things that are very different. I think that for us to remember this great person, the time that he was writing out of, the mind space, his own experiences, what he had been into in his own life, and what the concept of the anima meant in terms of a breakthrough for him. And then we're going to consider some of his statements and ask, well, what do we do with them in this day and age? And Hillman, in his book on the anima, asks the question, is that the task of this time to see what the function of the anima is now? And some of you, I know Hillman's book. So there's a wide range on the spectrum of where we may be going in these 2 days. And it's like we have the genie that we're going to let out of the bottle, or we're going to open Pandora's box. And I had to smile as I went back and looked at those two thoughts, because there, the genie is always the masculine, sitting there with his big Middle Eastern pantaloons and Pandora's box. So perhaps that's what we're about. I think Jung's first writings on the anima were in 1916. Some of this he revised in 1924 or 28, and some in 1935. And the classic work on the anima and the animus is in his 2 essays on analytical psychology, which is one of the collected works. And it's in this part on the relations between the ego and the unconscious. And that chapter 2 in there is really classic Jung. This is where we get the definition. And (clears throat) I want to start with a definition that Yolanda Jacoby, who was an old analyst in practice in Zurich when I first went there, put in her book on Jung's psychology. And this is the book, by the way, that got me through the exams in Zurich. It's right there. And she says, in this process of individuation, one of the stages that we go through is the encounter with the soul image, which in the man, Jung calls the anima, and in the woman, the animus. And then she has this to say about it. The archetypal figure of the soul image always stands for the complementary, contrasexual part of the psyche, reflecting both our personal relation to it and the individual human experience of the contrasexual. It represents the image of the other sex that we carry in us as individuals and also as members of the species. And then from there, we need to understand that when Jacoby or Jung are talking about a soul image, and Jung makes this very plain, the soul that he is talking about is not what is meant in Christian doctrine or in philosophical material, but he says that soul is a partly conscious, psychic complex. And of course we know that a complex is that entity in the psyche with its own life of its own. And I might give you his definition. It leads a separate existence cut off from consciousness. It's a vehicle of meaning that's usually unconscious. There are associations to it, and there are emotional tones drawn from personal disposition and the outer experience. And the common example, of course, is the Oedipal complex. And usually that's unconscious. And yet, sometimes it does bubble up. But it's an entity that works its way in us. We talk of the mother complex. You all know what a complex is. All right, Jung says the anima for men is an image, or it is the soul image. The anima is an image of the soul. An animus for women is an image of the soul. Let's just sort of put that on hold, and that's the beginning place. What is the source of this soul image? Jung said that there were three sources, he felt. And again, if I use the word anima, it's because it's where he was starting. And it's the same for animus. It's the dissimilar psychology of women that shapes anima in man. It's the opposite, the other. And it's the different psychology of the male human being who is a source, of course, for the animus in woman. And Jung was quite adamant about that, particularly when he was writing about the anima. And he goes on at quite length. It might be fun to read you that, but I want to move along here for time. But that male or female that we meet up with is one of the primary sources of the other within us, the contrasexual. Then Jung says the second source is man's inner feminine. And he goes on at quite length here, saying that there is a side of man who is, now listen to these words, tender and soft, that might be called feminine. Now he doesn't go into quite so much for the animus. He doesn't explore what this is, but he has some very definite ideas about what are feminine and that The man carries a part of that within him. We could counterbalance that, and I don't want to do this to where it's monotonous. The strength, the ability to discriminate, all of those things that are so-called masculine, that are woman's counterpart, contrasexual. That's a source of the animus. And the third way, of course, are the inherited collective images that we have experienced and inherited, the race's experience, I might say, of the other. Through the ages, woman's experience of men. And maybe this is where some of the imagery of our dreams come from. Because, you know, often we dream of men that we have never seen. Perhaps we read about them. Sometimes we haven't. But in that racial memory that we all carry. So those three sources that somehow come together within us to make what Jung calls the contrasexual. And the forms and the function, to really make this shorthand and concise, Jung said that the anima, and we know that both of these are the guide to the unconscious, the anima activates man's feeling side, the animus activates or enhances woman's intellectual side. Now again, let's just put that there and let it rest. We're going to have to come back and work over a lot of this. But I want us to start with what is classic. Maybe there's a better word. Maybe it's orthodox or fundamental. Fundamentalism. Maybe that. I don't know. And when I say these things, I'm not judging. I love Jung and I've committed. And I know there is an anima and I know there is an animus. From there, I don't know where I take it yet. But the forms of the anima and the animus show up in first human form. And then as we drop down into the unconscious, we get to the mythological figures, the Sphinx, the witch, the counterpart of that in the male, that would be the mythological figures. Halfway between consciousness, halfway between unconsciousness. And we kind of keep dropping on back through the animal kingdom, through the plant kingdom. And for those of you who have been around and heard me before, you know, one of our exciting things when we first used to work with us a long time ago was to trace the feminine archetype, as Jacobi does in her book, clear on back from the human, and it might be fun for me to do that, but let's see if I can find that right here. Clear on back to the abstract forms. Jacobi again is talking about the anima. You see, all this writing starts on that point. And that in itself is something we're going to have to talk about. The anima can equally well take the form of a sweet young maiden, a goddess, a witch, an angel, a demon, a beggar woman, a whore, a devoted companion, an Amazon, and so on. And then she lists a lot of anima figures. You've all been with speakers that have done this. You've all been with speakers that have listed animus figures. They are taken from literature, from films, from dreams. And we could do that, but I don't think that's necessary for us to do. Jacobi says the animus can also assume a variety of forms. Typical animus figures might be Dionysius, the Pied Piper, the Flying Dutchman, and on a lower, more primitive plane, a famous film star, a boxing champion, or in particularly troubled times like ours, an outstanding political or military figure. But the anima and animus can also be symbolized by animals. And that's true. You know, we think of a cat, we think of a dog. Immediately you know the difference. It's what we have put on these symbols. even by objects of a specifically masculine or feminine character, particularly when the anima or animus has not yet reached the level of the human figure. And so she traces this back. The anima can take the form of a cow, a cat, a tiger, a ship, a cave. And as I read all this stuff, think of where it fits in folk lore and folk wisdom. We're listening to something that has been somehow crystallized in the human psyche and then put out there. And then Jung says something interesting. He says, the first bearer of the soul image is always the mother. Later, it is borne by those women who arouse the man's feelings, whether in a positive or a negative sense. And I think that's a question, and I have a list of them, that when we really get into discussion, and it may not be today, we may have to just get this groundwork laid out here. If the first bearer of the soul image is the mother, what does that do to women? And how then can the animus be the soul image? So let's just keep tracking along and keep thinking and put your own questions in here as we go. Wanted to give you just a little bit broader view to move out from this such concrete meanings of anima and animus. In his book on the anima, Hillman writes about the anima, and he describes her real ability and her, we might say, faculty for imagination. The ability to actually put us in to active imagination. The anima deals with images and with feelings. She is the bridge to the known and the unknowable. And Hillman says she leads to the interior, and he doesn't mean what's inside the individual, but the interior of an image. Now that's profound, if you can get that. It's the anima function that takes us right into the inside of a symbol. And I dare say men are not the only ones that can do that. So, but the anima is marvelous to do that. I have an Alice Ann's in active imagination. The conversations, and the anima talks to them and tells them and guides them. And she literally puts them inside the images. And this is not new to many of you. You know what we're talking about. Okay, that's the anima. And the animus is generally associated with spirit, logos. The more impersonal, the more objective, the active. But again, the mediator to those great depths of the unconscious. And there's a marvelous essay or an article, Thomas More, he's written on the Animus Mundi. And he says that by putting the animus into the core of his theory, Jung gave thought a basis or a part in imagination. I want to read that over again for you, because we're really pushing on what the functions of the anima and the animus are. We might say, or we might paraphrase this, by giving the animus in woman the same kind of authority and equal billing. By putting the animus at the core of his theory, Jung gave thought a basis in imagination. And he indicates that thought itself doesn't necessarily come from consciousness or out of our ego space, but rather comes of its own accord, and that thoughts have an imaginal matrix, an abundance of images, and therefore they have depth and always signify more than we mean by them. And I think, have you ever wanted to describe something or had an experience, and there were no words for it. And then you felt something way down, almost in the root chakra, and it started bubbling, and you can feel it, and it kept on coming up and up and up, and finally it was here in the throat chakra, and there were some words. And I think that's what they're talking about here, that thought doesn't just come from up here. And maybe that's intuition gets wound up in this. But thought, too, you see, comes from those deeps, and the anima deals with those deeps in terms of thought, while the anima deals more in images. And I think okay, that's, you're jumping, and maybe we should jump to that. Because, yes, no, as I'm referring now to anima, this is anima in the male. Yes. And we are going to have to, because that's a question that is going to come up. And how do we decide what it is? I think it's very interesting that this writer, Thomas More, in talking about the depth and almost the poetry of the animus, feels like Hillman does about the anima. And they both describe it as the heart expressing itself. And it opens up this whole area that includes, we might say, our character, whatever it is that are in our deeps that are in us when the heart expresses itself. I suppose these are characteristics like will and passion when they're poured out. And Moore says, furthermore, as a spiritual force, the animus can be recognized as a creative daimon, and that's D-A-I-M-O-N, that kind of angel on one's shoulder. Or an ancestral spirit, or more transpersonally, as a divinity or a god discerned and defined by its phenomenal face, I got one too many in there, and voice. So we begin to see the depths of the animus also, and what it is that these two archetypes, one we kind of call the archetype of the feminine, and of course that's the anima, one the archetype of the masculine, and we've always separated them, though Jung always said anima and animus. Now, are there any questions at this point or anything you want to add? Because we're going to change pace here a little bit. Yes.
I have a question. From back where you were talking about the two sources of the soul,
mm-hmm.
I don't really get the differentiation between the first source, which you described as a similar psychology of the opposite, and the second source, which would be the inner opposite. I don't see that, like, wouldn't that be that, like, the similar psychology?
Did you all hear the question? Okay. What's the difference between the dissimilar psychology of woman and the inner psychology? One is out there, and a man may see it out there before he ever feels it in himself. The inner may be evoked by the outer because he has projected the inner onto it. But there is a real difference. Okay. Any other comments or?
What
We will go into that in depth, but I think right off, what is the relationship to these? First off is to become aware of them in their both light and dark aspects, their helpful, positive aspects, and their negative aspects. And, of course, the object of that is so that we don't project them onto other people. We don't see something in the other person that's in ourselves. A little more of that to elaborate on when we said that the function of the anima and animus is the gateway to the unconscious. That's why we need to be in touch with them, so that they can take us on this path of individuation, which means finding out really as many aspects or as many parts of ourselves that we can and integrating. And if you remember the talk on the shadow, that stuff also that gets put into a persona to where it freezes on us, all of those kinds of insights can be melted away by the anima or somehow differentiated by the animus. All right, now we're coming to Akwande. It was back, I think, about 1979 when I was at a conference at Notre Dame, and part of it was on anima and animus, that there was a low rumble on the ground, just barely discernible, from one of the young women speakers. Naomi Goldberg, maybe some of you know Naomi, she's still writing. And she was really questioning and challenging the fact of what Jung was crediting the animus with. And she said, I'm a woman, I don't need any inner man in me to be credited with that. And there were some other rumblings, yeah. And is man, like one of you asked back there, the only one to have an anima? This was the first time that I had questioned this. And my reaction then was one of, first anger. I felt very threatened. But this rumble began to grow. And it's really rocked through the whole Jungian community. And as you know, in many places, it's really become like a roar. Part of this, I think, has been fueled by the women's movement in the 70s and early 80s. But that wasn't all. Just as important to fuel this questioning, this challenging, was the impact of new physics, the concept of the hologram, the interfacing of the realm of science and the realm of religion, or the spiritual. And that one paradox, you know, that now we just take for granted of physics. Is it a wave or is it a particle? And the arguments. And finally somebody said, it's how you look at it. And people began to wonder, well, is this thing how you look at it? And Jungians were reading, they were writing. On their own, they were beginning to question. And this wasn't being done in a cynical or a destructive way. Most Jungians that I know truly respect and love Jung and think of the ground that he broke and the places that he has brought us. But we also know that Jung, were he here today, would, oh, gee, what would he have done in the 60s and 70s? And you've heard this before. But they were wanting to push these boundaries. And I know myself, my analysands had long learned that it didn't do much good to say, oh, that's my animus. Or the old anima got me again, because I would say, what does that mean? And usually when I first started doing that, there was a blank. You know, well, what's the animus? A label that you stick on something? And when I first said, what does that mean? There were a lot of blanks. But little by little, we begin to get underneath these labels, underneath these words. In the meantime, Jungians were writing, particularly the women analysts started. Hillman was exploring the anima. Flo Wiedemann and Polly Eisendrath's book on the development of the animus came out. You know some of John Beebe's work on with films on the anima and his kind of real interesting using the anima itself, the function of the anima, to explore the father's anima. There were Jungian analysts that weren't buying into this. There were some that were really feeling these contrasexual definitions that we've been holding here were adequate. And I know Anne Ulanoff in New York, some of you know her and have heard her, highly respected and dearly beloved analyst. And Anne really maintains that these contrasexual archetypes are the way that lead to the self. She has no trouble with there being anima in man and animus in woman. But others were, Andrew Samuels, Nathan Schwartz. But besides this, analysts begin to notice that dreams were different. And analysts' dreams themselves were different. Let me read you what one analyst wrote. Years ago in Zurich, while I read of masculine logos and spirit, panels of judgment and unyielding patriarchs, my nights were accompanied by such animus figures as these. A greengrocer who invited me to contemplate the night sky, a very earthy man, not the spiritual animus flying around. An African chieftain who objected to my made-up feminine persona. A pilot who brought our plane safely to earth in a forest clearing. A construction foreman who took me on a tour of a building under renovation. And I remember most fondly Mr. Bones, a skeletal figure who offered to instruct me in the arts of love and death, she questions. And then the night march of the frog musicians. They were male frogs drumming and tooting through a bourgeois neighborhood, waking up all the people and calling in basso profundo voices, come, come, join in the religious rite in celebration of sex. These were different kinds of animus figures showing up. And meanwhile, in this same analyst's dream, the feminine figures included a warrior queen, an abbess, and a figure that I took to be the Blessed Virgin. These and other female images of primary authority in their realms, both spiritual and worldly. And she says, in spite of all my studies and all of this, I tried to continue to think in the terms presented by the readings and by my analysts. And then, and only then, the animus grew hostile, indifferent, or threatened robbery and rape. It took a while, and the later additional evidence provided by a number of female analysands before I began more consciously to restructure my thinking to match the images, the facts presented by the psyche. And I think that last paragraph is so important, that we restructure our thinking to match the images. That we don't come out with a label that says, this is the picture of the psyche, and it means this, this, and this. And that women are going to be advised by the animus, and men by the anima. Because you know what they were finding, other analysts? That women were being guided by women, not just men, in their dreams. That these women were many of the goddesses Demeter, Persephone. And in the men's dreams, they too were being guided by females and many kinds of women, not just so much of the romantic, erotic image of the anima that usually are what we used to hear about when we heard of examples of anima. You know, poor Marilyn Monroe, and now it would be Madonna, carried all that weight of the anima. But that's just part of her. And in the men's dreams themselves, there was Demeter and Persephone. Sometimes there was even Artemis. And these women were giving advice to women. Men were getting advice from men and from earth men as well as from Madonna or Marilyn Monroe, whatever age. So we see that there's something shifting here. And maybe this is keeping time with what was going on in the 70s. Maybe the images that began to appear in people's dreams, like the earth men, and when I say that, I mean the earthy man, were a part of that back to the land, that whole thing that got started in the 70s. The inner and the outer begin to mesh, and there are great changes going on. Now, I want to stop here and see where we are, if you have questions or comments. I'm so much in agreement that I don't know how to add to that. What do you want to say, or can you say it again? Because I think that that's one of the things. As we trace back, anima and animus have pretty much been gender-defined, haven't they? And I have a quote in here from Jung when he's talking about the importance of the male discovering the anima. But he says, you know, it really doesn't make any difference if a young man to mid-age, and he puts in parentheses around 35, has lost the anima completely. Because that stage of life is important. A man should be a man. And again, let's not fault Jung. He was coming out of a Swiss Protestant, middle European, 1920s, 30s, when a man to be a man didn't have many of these anima qualities, did he? Then how ironic, though, that he couldn't understand what caused his dream when Europe would run with blood and he would put it all on Wotan. You see, if the anima had been around in young men before 35, maybe Wotan wouldn't have gotten so many strokes. So yeah, I think the anima and animus was gender defined. And I have pages of that, and I'm not going to read it because I think there's such good discussion waiting. Defining these two terms in just those characteristics. And you've all heard the negative anima that makes a man whiny, negative, pouty. You all know this material. Give me some more adjectives. And what does the poor old negative animus do? Well, he makes her opinionated and bossy and so on and so on and so on. Okay, those characteristics which in one sex were considered okay, but when they were in the other sex, they were negative. And I think this brings to the question, it's a question that Hillman asks and that Schwartz picks up on. How is it that we can call these qualities in one sex the anima, but in the other sex the shadow, and make shadow negative? Why is it that a man who is Oh, tender and... wrestling with this, or you certainly have ideas about it. And let's take a few minutes here before, and we should have a break. We've got all kinds of mechanics to look after here. What are your thoughts on what we're saying right now? What do you want to get into with this? Yes. Saying that there's just one of these opposites in us, you're saying that just the opposite for woman, which would be the animus, is in there. No anima?
No, what I'm saying is that given that...
How would you see that feminine being manifested?
How would I see the feminine being manifested mm-hmm. in a woman?
Well, if you're saying it's in the unconscious, and we've talked about the...
for example, when...
Okay. Yes, thank you. I think we're leading up to the next part that I want to take off with. It's almost a good springboard into it. Now, it's about 8:30. Perhaps we should take a break, and then we'll come back and see how far we can get. Okay. I'd like to back up. Now, how is this? Okay. Is it okay, Kate? All right. Because as Jungians got into this quandary, began to study and to read, and all of them were thinking, some of Jung's early writings that had almost got skimmed over quickly or had frozen in their words were re-looked at. And there's a statement of Jung's in the archetypes and the collective unconscious, where he's talking about the archetypes and the concept of the anima, which then he does enlarge into the animus. But he says this, "I must emphasize that the concept of the anima is a purely empirical concept, whose sole purpose is to give a name to a group of related or analogous psychic phenomena. The concept does no more and means no more than that." And he says it doesn't mean any more than when we say the word anthropods, which simply includes all animals with articulated body and limbs, and so gives a name to this group. All right, the anima is a concept. It's a name to give to a group of related psychic phenomena. And remember back there when I said for us to put up the word anima or animus and say, this is a picture of the psyche. This is the soul image. And then to delineate, bing, 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 what that is and what that does and how it shows up. That's not what Jung had in mind. And it kind of reminds you, you know, of sacred literature, of teachings of great teachers, even the struggle that we've seen in many religions when the words get frozen and become what people say is it. And somehow I think anima and animus got frozen. Because then he goes on and he says this, and this is, I think, the crux of where this whole thing turns tonight. This is a statement that's been picked up by Hillman and Nathan Schwartz, some of you have heard, you know his books on narcissism. He's picked up this comment. And it is this, and it is just a couple paragraphs after Jung has talked about this concept. And Jung says, "Anyone, therefore, who does not know the universal distribution and significance of the syzygy motif in the psychology of primitives, in mythology, in comparative religion, and in the history of literature, can hardly claim to say anything about the concept of the anima. I'm going to read that again. Syzygy is S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. I'll give you definition. It's a good word. It leaps out like animus. Anyone, therefore, who does not know the universal distribution and the significance of the syzygy motif in all these things, the psychology of primitives, in mythology, in comparative religion, in the history of religion, and the history of literature, can hardly claim to say anything about the concept of the anima. And let me give you a definition of syzygy. Syzygy, it's a very simple definition, straight out of the Webster's unabridged thing that's this thick. Any two related things, either alike or opposite. Isn't that wonderful? So the anima and animus are syzygy. They're related. They're opposite. It could be, a syzygy could be two related things. It could be alike. And when Jung is talking about the universal distribution of the syzygy, he is talking about all of those divine pairs that we find in all of these fields that he talked about, whether it's religion, mythology, literature, whether it's in alchemy, the tarot. But it's the divine pair that's always together. This has shown up in dreams. Jung notes three of them in his writings of the Swiss mystic, and I didn't put his name down, but that he was dreaming of the king of heaven, and seated right next to him was the queen of heaven. And if you know Hindu, you know Shiva and Shakti, and that's been likened to the gold and the luster of the gold. How can you separate them? And yet they are separate. But the syzygy, this two related things that are opposite or alike, this dream of the syzygy has showed up so many, many times. Many of you who have read Jung remember the story of Brother Klaus and some of his dreams and images. This poor Swiss peasant who could never have had access to the sacred literature where the syzygy was talked about. And yet he dreamed of God as father, God as mother. Now look what we're touching on, where we're coming into even some of the struggles of today's churches in what language to use as we address God. So Jung says, anybody that doesn't know about this, you can't talk about the animus, the anima. And he could have said, or the animus. Now, I want to pick up here with Nathan Schwartz and read you just a little bit, which maybe now will seem redundant, but it kind of fits in. I think that I'm not going to read all of this because I want to get more time for us to discuss, and we shouldn't go forever here. But Schwartz is talking about the syzygy, and in the paper that he gave at a conference at Ghost Ranch a couple summers ago, he was reviewing for that group, like I've reviewed for you, some of his quandary and his problems over all of this. And he too lands on this paragraph that I've just read to you. And he also notes that Hillman landed on that paragraph. He says, almost as an afterthought in his book, The Anima, in his last chapter, that he entitled The Anima in the Syzygy. And Nathan goes on then to talk about Hillman's thoughts on this. And I'm going to hold that for next week. I want to go right to Nathan's. Because he says, when Hillman says the anima in the syzygy, he's implying a relationship with the counterpart. Now, Hillman doesn't get into that. He takes off in a different track. But when we're talking about the syzygy, and we can't talk about the anima without the animus, what does that say to you? What's your reaction to this statement?
Can't have one without the other.
Right. So what does that mean? No, we can't have one without the other. Now that would kind of begin to talk about the androgyny that somebody was talking about, wouldn't it? Okay, now say that again.
Oh, really?
you want me to restate it? I think I did. You're saying that the two-faced God that is turned in either direction, back of that is something.
There's a central face, both derived.
So where's the syzygy? Which is what's in the syzygy?
Well, the syzygy is what happens when you enter the realm where things are divided into the pairs of opposites. Then they're the two that must be together to form the whole. But on the other side, where you're not in the realm where things are in pairs of opposites, there is only the whole, which is the source of the reason that a concept like syzygy exists.
Anybody? What you think?
So, to some extent,
and what was that word? A syzygy is a what? Yeah, a pair of related things. And that's where I hear you saying, and you're saying in this related. So if we were to draw two circles, just the fact that they're there, that's not it. It's what's going on between. Okay. What does go on between? What?
Ultimately, your development is integration.
Only because of the
conflict.
But we got anima and animus. What happens if somebody said desire? That's interesting. Pick up on that, David.
I guess it's that I keep getting this feeling that it's that the syzygy is a necessary tension between two aspects which are at one and the same time separate but always mutually attractive.
Why would that be? Why would they need each other? Listen, we're on new ground. Nobody knows anything here. We just are after good new questions.
Well,
that's probably it, isn't it? The desire, yeah. Oh, there's so many good hands. Don't go away. By the same fact, we've got to say part of the time what it is. Okay, I agree, Clarice. Yes. And I think that's right. Now, go ahead. I believe the man behind you and then you. That's probably true.
Yeah, a little like positive and negative ions come together, but then they can't resist one
We need them for that whole connection, don't we? And that they can't resist, you say, that would get into the desire, that in and outness. All right. Mm-hmm. It holds it. It keeps it. Yes. Mm-hmm. And there's something very subtle in that, isn't there? Because we always think of heat and cold as opposites, but they're alike because they're all their temperature. We don't say height and heat are opposites. We say heat and cold. It's almost like there's got to be some similarity before you can be opposite. I don't want to get wordy and funny here, but yeah. Now I want to come back. If we're talking about this within one, and you were talking about the wholeness, What's the difference that we're talking about if this syzygy is within us? Then, if there's just an animus in woman, where is the syzygy in that paradigm? Where's the linkage? Mm-hmm. In our ego consciousness. And that's why we're always being told that we need to be aware of the anima, the animus. It needs to be integrated. And so if we're thinking of the syzygy within us, what does this do? Where do we start, or what are we aware of? Could you give, it's hard, can you give an example? What, or can anybody help us out here? Because we've got to pull this down into where it's grounded, or it's not going to. If we're talking about the syzygy within us and this complementing and this interaction, if that is true, how is that different than if we say there's only an animus in woman? And David suggested the answer to that was, well, if there's only an animus, then the ego has to carry and compensate. But if there's a syzygy, if both are in us, what part does the ego play? That is hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Larry, and then we'll come back.
Couldn't the opposite be gone? Couldn't it be stored in shadow?
Do all of you know the term shadow? I think you do. Yeah, because I think... and you're saying, could it be stored in the shadow?
In the opposite sense. Animals and animals be stored in the shadow. Culturally conditioned in the ego to accentuate, you know, the oneness that the animal. Animals just kind of impress the subconscious.
So what does that do with the ego? Mm-hmm. What do you think the ego's job is in this? You had a... No, okay. Synergy picks up right at the end of her question. Because is it the job of the ego to get them together? What did you say? Or is it the job of the ego to be aware of both of those and to listen? Now that's something. Have you ever been aware of the war in yourself? Or maybe wars. And what is, well, have you ever been aware of the opposites in yourself? When you're trying to make a decision, and you get a pencil if you're a thinking paper, thinking person, and you make a pro and a con column. And I never was able to do that because my feelings go, nye. All right. What the syzygy within, and what does the ego do? Marla, you had a hand up. That the animus has an anima, and the anima has an animus. And we could keep on going with that. And I'm not being flip. And now that you're all laughing, I got to tell you, you remember the joke about the woman who thought that the turtle held the world on its back? And somebody said, well, what's under the turtle? Another turtle. Well, what's under that turtle? She says, it's turtles all the way down. And it is. Anima, animus, anima, till finally, maybe we're into that space that some of the sacred writings talk about. And then I know there were a lot of hands. I think you and then you and then a couple over here. And go ahead. Guided more by what was going on between them. Instead of, and I understand what you mean when you say which one to listen to. But again, to get to what people have been saying about holding that tension of the opposites. Because they're in some kind of a relationship. And if it's a negative, what does that mean? If it's a positive, are you getting over-identified? Or, because it seems if we only choose which one we're going to listen to, then we're back to where we were with the ego siding with one or the other. Do you follow me? Although I really sympathize with your quandary. Let's have a couple here or questions, I thought. No? Okay. David, and then Larry. And I think the war is a case in point, isn't it? Each of you know in some way what that means for you and how you have to bear and live with the reality of what's going on. And I'm tracking with you. Mm-hmm. And to hold in yourself that terrible tension, knowing where you are and yet knowing the other piece. Larry, You had a comment. I think we've... He has to make up his mind if he's going or if he isn't going, and if either one of those carries a whole line of consequences that he has to meet one at a time. Well, now you're slipping back, I think, into the gender, like when Jung said, you know, up to 35, it doesn't matter if a young man loses the anima completely. The importance of that stage of life is for a man to be a man. Well, who says what being a man is? Now, if he does, that's okay. But maybe he... Well, but do we always go with what's culturally determined and define ourselves? See, I told you we were opening Pandora's box.
Yeah. The ego was positioned in Dr. Levy's, you know, diagram.
You know, we've all struggled to put this thing in a diagram. And just because you brought it up, let me show you something. But this is how I used to teach this stuff. And I thought, well, you know, and you can't diagram it. And when I was saying, here's this good old book that got me through Zurich, and Jacoby has marvelous diagrams. And we tried so hard to talk about this wonderful mystery. And what Clarice said, you know, we don't dare give it too hard a form. But we used to, some of you will remember and laugh at this thing. We were trying to say this is a slice of the psyche, or this is the psyche in a cone. Up here on top was the ego where it confronted the outer world. In here someplace was the persona next to the ego, that stuff that we put on us. Round in here someplace, part conscious and part unconscious, was the shadow. And of course, this whole realm of the ego is consciousness. And you drop below that, and there's some stuff that's the personal unconscious, our own unique, funny little traits that either we've repressed or because we are each individual's. They're in there, and they've never—they're different than the other person's. That personal unconscious material. Below that was the collective unconscious, and then the unconscious, which probably in this life can never be gotten to. And this was left open-ended, and almost went out into where, if you really wanted to, you could draw a big circle all around this and the outer world, and call it the self. And somewhere the anima and animus was mediating between the collective and the personal unconscious. And, of course, as that was made manifest, came into consciousness. So I don't know where Bill got his map. I can really appreciate his struggle in trying to get this out there. But I don't think we should carry any map unless you're taking exams, and that's what I did with the book. Although I think there's some relevance in what you're talking about, the ego's working with the persona, But when that persona gets plastered to us, yeah, then we accept definition as a woman from what culture says it is.
I don't mean to say it can't be altered.
Okay.
I mean, they're alterable. All that is excessive. But I think artificial intelligence, which is in my introspection, it's very clear that there's a movement in your own past.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Practicing, you know, when you start with your sequential fashion, it's not a random.
Yeah, and I'm not clear exactly what you mean, the process, because Yacobi, in her book, says the second stage of individuation is when you confront the anima and the animus. But out of my own experience as an analyst and most of my colleagues, this doesn't go in sequence. You don't always meet the shadow. And then you settle all that, and you meet the contrasexual, and then you meet the self. Sometimes the initial dream, which Jung said was so important because really it diagnosed and laid out the treatment, that'll bring in a self so big it fills the room. And you never ever heard of shadow or archetypes. So individuation is not sequential exactly. And you're talking of something else. Okay. Okay.
And the reason it might bypass one area or another is because that's a trodden path.
That's, I see, okay. I don't mean to cut you off. I know I haven't settled this. Let's take one more question, and then I think we should kind of go out and mull over and come back next week, and we'll pick up. I do want to read you one little paragraph from Nathan before you leave. Mm-hmm. I think I agree with you. I think. I think again of, is it a wave or is it a particle? And if I had had another diagram, I could hang you another way. Let me read something from Nathan. At this stage in our discussion, this may not be as powerful as it might have been, but I think it fits right in with when we're trying to say which one do we listen to and we're trying to understand this relationship between. Clearly, Jung felt the need for parts, anima and animus, to be related to a representation of one world, and that's in quotes, and found the link in the syzygy. If Jung's commitment had only been to exploring the psyche's phenomenology in terms of what appears to be masculine imagery in a woman and feminine imagery in a man, there would have been no need to postulate the ordering capacity of the syzygy. And I think that's very important here, the ordering pattern. And I think that's why I was a little bit of a quandary when you said, which one shall you listen to? Because it's out of that inner dialogue between them that there comes some kind of an ordering pattern for us. One could then study the anima or the animus and essentially do away with an overriding form that encompasses them both. Yet Jung did not do this, and I believe that he followed the path he chose because of his personal and clinical experience. And at the conference where this paper was given, there was a lot of controversy that arose over some of the papers, some of the very ideas that we've been talking about. over some internal Jungian stuff of therapists and or analysts and analysands treatment, handling countertransference. There was just a whole mess of stuff. And it kept building and building, and people trying to understand each other, people hurting each other, women attacking women, women attacking men, men attacking men, men attacking women. It was just one of those things that sometimes groups get in. And the anima, positive and negative, was there, as we've defined her. And the animus, positive and negative, was there. And you know what Nathan said? He said, we're in the syzygy. And I think that is a... I like it when the number of you said you got to tie this down to concrete and personalize it. We're in the syzygy. So with that, I bid you all a good night. And...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.